Today I continue and conclude a recording of Joel Goldsmith, a mystic, author, healer, and teacher. Stay tuned. This is Robin Clare with Tributaries.
And whatever way you do it, you finally arrive at the conviction Christ is man's only being. Christ is our only true identity. You rest in that, and then afterwards see it fulfilled. Now, how can you sit and look at grip and flu and pneumonia and all the rest of these things without fear when the other person is busily rushing around taking protective serums and one thing and another about it? Only because of a developed inner consciousness that has already risen to that degree above the evidence of the senses. Now, so it is. As we study, as we read, we are studying and reading things that are antagonistic to the human mind and which the human mind has no way of knowing or recognizing. So how, then, are you going to know them unless you also have that developed, or, in the case of some few, natural, inner, intuitional faculty? The development of that faculty comes not only through study, but more even than through study, through meditation. There are many people who have been studying writings, metaphysical writings, for 10, 20, 30 years, and haven't even glimpsed one tiny glimpse of spiritual vision. They're reading with a mind, and they never get beyond that point of reading with their mind. At no point does some intuitional thing come in and reveal that which is written between the lines. Take the statement, "My kingdom is not of this world," or "My peace I give unto you." Now, people read that over and over and over again, "My peace I give unto you," and probably they are thinking about the man Jesus who spoke it. And I say, well, what good is it? He isn't here to give us that peace, and that ends it. And yet we come along and we say, oh, my peace. I understand that doesn't mean this human sense of peace. That is something that transcends it. You have caught with your inner vision the meaning that even the minister in the church, more often than not, fails to perceive, that there is such a thing as a my peace. A peace that has nothing to do with anything that is understood by peace on the human plane. In the same way as it is read, it is written, not by might, nor by power, but by my spirit, saith the Lord. And to the average reader reading with his mind, there is about as meaningless a statement as one could find. What do you mean, not by might and not by power, when all that human existence knows is might and power, either physical or mental? Then you say, well, now, wait a minute. I cannot use physical might in this matter, or even legal might, and I cannot use mental powers. What am I to do? Then something within says, but by my spirit, spirit of God, and then you're able to get quiet and let this my spirit take over, and then you have the experience of David and Goliath, and David says, but I come to you in the name of God, without armor on. No, he could not fit that physical armor on him. It just wouldn't fit his state of consciousness at all. And so he says, I go out without armor, but I come in the name of the Lord. And in the name of the Lord, he stands there just ready to be cut down. And it doesn't happen. There again, you say, we stand in the presence of sin, disease, lack, limitation, fear, infection, contagion, and we do not surround ourselves by might, nor by power, but just with a silence. And we really and truly have faith in that silence. Not just a blind faith. We have an awareness that if we attain a deep enough silence, the entire visible picture will change, and it does. Now, that has all come to you through this inner vision, through this inner ability to discern that which humankind never will. The things of God are foolishness with men. The mortal man cannot know them, Paul tells us. Cannot know the things of God at all. And if ever there is a statement of Paul that is true, it is that very one, that the natural man perceiveth not the things of God. And you might as well make up your mind to that, that no matter how much truth you ever know through books, no matter how much truth you ever learn through teachers, you are never going to perceive the things of God unless, in a degree, you do develop this soul consciousness, reveal, unfold, bring forth this inner vision that can see that which is invisible, hear that which is inaudible, and know that which is unknowable. Now, the reading helps that, the hearing helps that, everything we do in the way of lecture work, class work, all it helps. But all these things are merely helps to the main factor, which is the meditation. The meditation must accompany all of our reading and hearing. And that's why I say meditation becomes a mental practice if it's prolonged. It would be far better to sit in meditation for 2 or 3 or 4 minutes and then get up and go about our business than to sit for 2 or 3 hours. It is not possible at this period of our development, I'm speaking now as a general rule, to sit for more than a few moments without the mental faculties coming into play again, thought coming in. And that we must avoid. It would be far better to have 10 periods a day of 2 minutes each than to have 1 period of 10 hours. There comes a time when we can sit sometimes a whole hour or two and be so lost in the spirit that it seems to us like 2 or 3 minutes. It's only by looking at the clock that you find out that an hour or 2 or 3 has passed. But those experiences are not such that you can say, I can do that at will. It is not possible to do that at will. It is only possible to do that by grace. You can force yourself. Many Orientals force themselves to sit hours and hours and hours in meditation, which isn't a communion with the Spirit. If it were a communion with the Spirit, they come out of it so full of the Spirit that their lives would show forth tremendous things. Instead of, in most cases, they show forth a very ugly thing. But there are those who, through the practice, ultimately do come to where they could sit for 10 years in meditation and really be in communion with the Spirit. But that is an unusual soul. That is a highly developed spiritual consciousness. Ordinarily, at our stage, if we can maintain for 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 minutes a meditation without a mental activity, that is good. Then, as we progress further, we can maintain it for 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 20 minutes. Rarely does it go beyond that, except in those moments of grace when the Spirit takes over and it may keep you there for a full day or all night. But when you come out of it, it will seem as if you had been there only a few moments or a few minutes. However, the point is that in developing this, try it only for periods of 2, 3, or 4 minutes. And or 5 at the most, and more frequent periods, until you can tell yourself when it is becoming a task, a labor, or when the mental is starting to take over again. Then stop it. Meditation does not necessarily mean getting messages or seeing lights or scenes. The meditation itself is an acknowledgement that I can of my own self do nothing, and I'm sitting here now waiting for something greater than I to reveal itself. So the very act of doing this, even for 1 second, would be an act of meditation that would bear ultimately very rich fruit. It would be like lifting the telephone receiver and waiting for a message. Sooner or later, someone will come on and you'll receive the message. Now, just by closing your eyes for a second, opening that inner ear, you have opened the way to this inner awareness, and then you may have no message that time. You may have no reaction, no feeling. But you have opened the way, and it may be while you're driving your car or eating your meal or taking your bath or sleeping that the message will come through, but you will be instantly aware of it. If you're asleep, it will awaken you. You have opened yourself to it. That's all that you need do. You need not wait for it to come unless there is some specific reason why you must have that answer at this very second. But ordinarily, that is not true. And what we are doing is developing a line through to the soul at the center of us. Now, after weeks, months of this type of meditation, the line is continuously open. And from then on, you are, in some measure, in a constant state, a continuous state of meditation. In fact, you rarely leave it. Even in sleep, the line is wide open. You can be awakened. Anything you may be doing at any moment will not interfere with it. The line is open. You have made the contact. It is somewhat like being here in the center, in a groove, in a rhythm, separate and apart from the world. And that is a more or less continuous state. As if you were living right out here in a rhythm, out here is the rest of the world, but you're right here in the center of it, and supported by that rhythm. I catch the Paul statement, I live, yet not I, Christ liveth my life. It's almost as if I weren't living it, it were living it, and I were going along. In one of our classes, it was brought to our attention, this quotation of Saroyan, that man does not live his own life. God lives man's life. Man just goes along for the ride. And that is the feeling you get, that you are just going along and that it is living your life. It functions for you. You sit to answer mail and it comes along with the right answers for it. You are to give a treatment, and it comes along and gives you the right treatment. You are to make a decision, but you never do make it. It makes the decision for you, and you just accept the decision. Very much like the disciples, Judas had committed suicide, and the 11 are left, and they had to choose a 12th, and then they pray, Father, show us whom thou hast chosen. And then they just go along and cast their votes for the one that God has chosen. How do they know? It's put right into their mind, that's all. It's the one name that comes to all of them unanimously. And so it is. We need not break our heads who to vote for. We learned that back in our church organization days when we were electing readers or board members and wanting to be scientific or spiritual about it, instead of humanly deciding who we would like to see in the desk or on the board, we would sit in quietness, and pretty soon the name would come. And if we really were in tune, that's who was elected. If we weren't in tune, it was just an evidence that personal sense had gotten in, either with us or with the membership. Now, for us then, the most important point is the development of our meditation, because that is the development of our inner faculties. And it is with our inner faculties that we discern truth right where appearances seem to be. The next part of our experience, and that on which we build our experience, are the two great commandments. The two commandments given us by the Master, both of which, of course, were taken from Hebrew Scripture. One from the book of Exodus and the other from the book of Leviticus. The reason for the importance, or rather the importance of knowing this, is that we should all be very familiar with the fact that truth is universal, just as we should all know that do unto others as you would have others do unto you, goes back 3,500 years before the Master. We should all know that, because we should come to the realization that all real truth, all spiritual truth, is not Hebrew, is not Jewish, is not Christian, but is universal. And even before Abraham was, all true, real, universal truth was. And that will break down for us our belief in personal messages or personal teachings, and convince us of the need to know all that is universal and accept all those who have been messengers as that which they really were, messengers of the Word, bearers of the Word. In his lectures on the present world conditions, Mr. Toynbee tells us that there is a way to stop this destruction of civilization, and that way is if a new religion could be brought into the world, and that would be the same for the Jew and the Greek, the bond and the free. In other words, if a religion could be conceived so universal that no one would say my religion or bar somebody from it, have a universal God, the moment we would come into that realization, freedom would be. Well, of course, that's very evident to you by the fact that we here are at peace because we have one God, one religion. And gratefully, that God and that religion is not confined to a church or even to a teaching. We acknowledge that this principle is the universal one governing all being. And of course, if all men could see that, they'd be as much at peace with each other as we are with each other here. Now, the first great commandment is the first Hebrew commandment, the first of the Ten Commandments, not to acknowledge any other but the one God. Thou shalt have no other gods before me. Now you know, we have seen God as the creative principle of the universe. Once you see God as the only creative principle of the universe, you have seen the most important point of all, that there can be no power, reality, or effect from anything except that which emanates from God. As a matter of fact, you can understand that there isn't anything in existence except that which emanates from God, if you have seen God as the only creative principle. How impossible would it be for God to be the only creator, and for God to be infinite, and for some evil to be in existence? That was where you come to the experience of David. If we come in the name of the Lord, if we come in the recognition of no other power than God's power, we need not use might nor power for any purpose. The Spirit of the Lord is the only power there is, the only presence there is, the only all that there is. In the same way, if we acknowledge no other life but the life of God, you see that eventually we would understand that we have no life to age or to die. we would very quickly lose the personal sense of life and begin to see life as the universal life of all being. It is like watching a garden, and there you see 12, 15, 20 different species or varieties of flowers, plants, and yet if you were just to look a little below the ground, you'd find that there's only one life functioning down there. There's only one law, one power functioning down there, and it acts upon the lotus, the lily, the peaches, the pears, the plums, whatever it is that's planted there. Only one life, regardless of the infinite form and variety of its appearance. So you say, ah, then the life of one is the life of the other, and the life is indestructible. The life is always there. Now, there is a connecting link between that and our individual experience. Sometimes we believe that this that we behold in the mirror is our being. And we say, well, everything seems to age, everything seems to die and pass away, the flowers, the leaves. True, the tree remains, and next year you have new flowers or new leaves. Eventually you say, yes, but even the tree goes. Ah, there is the subject of false identity. We are not the tree, and we are not the flowers, and we are not the branches or the leaves. We are the life flowing through. It is as if you were to witness your fingernails being manicured, pared, and the remains of them being thrown in the fire, or your hair being cut, and the cuttings being thrown in the fire. And you say, what difference does it make? I am not there. Well, ultimately, you must come to see that they could throw the whole body there, and you wouldn't be there. They could take the nails and the hair and the toes and the legs and the arms and ultimately all of you and throw it in the fire, but you would not be there because you are the life of the body. You are not the body. Now, it is the same when you witness a tree or a plant in dissolution. Please do not believe for a moment that you are witnessing a plant or tree in dissolution. You are witnessing the outer form disappear while the tree itself remains. The tree is the life. That which you see with your eye is but the concept of its form. What happens to it has nothing to do with tree itself. Now you watch this in your own being as your fingernails and toenails are removed and your hair is cut away. Watch also then and notice how your skin keeps sloughing off. Always you are having new skin. The skin is always sloughing. Matter of fact, medical science tells us that every year, every cell and every drop of blood in the body is renewed. Everyone is renewed. Everyone has a complete new body every year. Ah, but we are still there. So you are going to find that ultimately you are still here even if they shovel your body into a fire. You'll probably be standing there watching it with as much amusement as you would if they were throwing the hair cuttings or nail cuttings onto the fire. With as much indifference, too. Because you are eternal. And the reason you are eternal is God is your life. God is your individual identity, and it never dies. You never die. You never even pass on. You are always here witnessing these changes of body, which really aren't changes of body so much as they are changes of concepts of body. The body itself you have never seen, unless in a deep meditation you may have seen spiritual creation. Sometimes when we are in the depths of meditation, completely absent from this sense of body, there is the vision of reality. And that encompasses the reality of heaven and of earth. And then you begin to see that which is the reality of your being and the reality of your body. And then you can understand why not only being is immortal, body is immortal. The only thing changes is our concept of body. That continuously changes until all concepts have been given up through our working with the idea of is. Someday you will work a long enough period with the idea of is. That means putting no labels on anything. In other words, for instance, saying body. Just take the word body and acknowledge that you do not know what body is. There's only one thing you really know about body, and that is that body is. You are aware of it, so you know that it is. But anything beyond that at this present moment is a concept. It may be your concept of body, or it may be a concept that you've accepted from universal belief. It may be a concept that has been handed down to you through racial or religious or national belief. And so you entertain this concept of body. But you know nothing about body at this minute. And so you can acknowledge, yes, body is. What is body? And that sets up the question, which is the vacuum, the state of receptivity. From there on, that within you, the spiritual sense, must define to you what body is.
We've been listening to a talk given by Joel Goldsmith, inspirational teacher, healer, and mystic who passed away in 1964. For any guest information, to listen to archives, share resources, and sign up for weekly programming, it's tributariesradio.wordpress.com. And for podcasting on iTunes, Tributaries Radio. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for staying tuned.